All right. Thank you all for being here. This is the first of our theology sessions. We have quite a few this weekend. And our first speaker this afternoon is Dr. Jimmy Davis. Jimmy is speaking on the impact of natural theology and revealed theology upon one's view of nature and God. And Dr. Davis is the Hammons Professor of Chemistry at Union University.
Thank you. I'm not used to reading and doing this at the same time, so it's going to be a little clumsy. Natural theology has been an important topic in both Catholic and Protestant thought, with the names of St. Thomas Aquinas and the Reverend William Paley coming to mind. Additionally, I've heard natural theological arguments all my life in church, usually never labeled as such. I've also noticed that natural theological arguments work well in Sunday school, but do not have much of an impact on non-believers that I know. This paper grew out of its desire to understand how natural theology developed, its relationship to revealed theology, and its impact on one's view of God and nature. Here's the outline. First, I'll give a brief historical overview of the development and use of both natural and revealed theology. Challenges to English natural theology, which I think people in the United States have grown out of, and a case study, the impact of natural and revealed theology on the thinking of Charles Darwin and Asa Gray, and then some final thoughts. Natural theology grew out of the rationalism of the Greeks, while revealed theology grew out of the holy books of the Hebrews. My definition of natural theology is natural theology starts with observations of nature and employs reason, the rationalism, to provide proof for the existence of God. Both Socrates and Plato did natural theological arguments, but for the sake of time, I'm just going to start with Aristotle. Aristotle, in both physics and metaphysics, presented his argument of the unmoved mover, which is a classical natural theological argument. This unmoved mover produced all the motion in the universe by being loved, which attracted things to him, or it, which produced all the order seen in the heavens and the earth, and this unmoved mover could be called God, which is a living, eternal, most good being. And good is an important word there. From the Roman point of view, we could do Cicero, because he will his impact is long also. He compared the ori mechanical device, that was a device that was used to predict the position of planets, eclipses, things like that. And he said, this is an amazing device, but think about the heavens themselves. They're even more amazing. If a mind made the ori, then a mind made the heavens. Another classical argument. The Hebrews were interested in declaring the goal of the glory of God rather than a proof of God. If you think about it, there is no proof of God per se in the Bible. They did not focus on the God of creation. Elohim is there, but they focused most of their narratives on Yahweh, because this was the God of covenants, relationships, moral relationships, and history as played out through prophecy. Or maybe prophecy played out through history. The early church fathers grew out of this revealed theology. An example of that is Justin Martyr in his First Apology, which presented the life of Jesus as foretold in the books of the prophets as a way to confront the pagan society that he was in. So, again, using Yahweh's example. By the time of Augustine, Christian theologians began contrasting knowing by reason and knowing by faith. And Augustine used knowing by reason, but he said that if it came down to it, he would choose faith, because not all church teachings could be demonstrated, and not all can understand rational proofs. And so That's where we were. From Augustine to Thomas, the 8th and 12th centuries were dominated by the monasteries. The 12th and 13th centuries, if you've ever studied European history, was so very exciting. This is when the universities was found. This is when scholasticism developed and flourished. And importantly for this story, this is when the Latin translations and the ancient Greek scholars, especially Aristotle, developed. Aristotle and his complete system was a great shock to the Europeans, and so there had to be a response to Aristotle. And one of the best responses was St. Thomas Aquinas. And in his writings, he used both natural and revealed theology. Thomas's thoughts for this paper are recorded in the Summa Contra Gentiles and the Summa Theologiae, both about 1270. The Summa Contra Gentiles was written as a manual to aid missionaries, to those pagans who did not accept the authority of Christian scripture. So if they're not going to accept scripture, what should we present them? And he said we should present rational arguments. And he based his approach to God as a three-way hierarchical approach based on Job 26:14. Lo, these things are said in part of his ways, and seeing we have heard a little drop of his word, who shall be able to behold the thunder of his greatness? And you notice I've highlighted three words. The first way is the way, the first step of the hierarchical approach is God's ways or creation, which then leads to his word. And then once you know the true God, then that leads you to a personal beholding of that God. So as most know, in his the Summa that most people think of when they say the word Summa, he presented his five arguments regarding the existence of God: the argument of the unmoved mover, which we've seen before from Aristotle, the argument of the first cause, the argument from contingency, the argument from degree, and the argument from design. And I think, I personally thought that the argument of design was the only argument until I was deep into this paper. And so, if these arguments lead you to a belief that there is a mind behind nature, then it's natural then to acquire to the conditions of his existence, and that leads to the second and third steps. But it's important to remember that Thomas said there are four disadvantages of knowing God by only natural theology. First, there's only a few people able to do the serious study required. It takes a long time if it's serious study. We have an infirmity of our judgments, which can lead to false opinions. And real truth about God comes by faith through revelation. And he gave many examples, but one of them is God is three and God is one. Similar to what Augustine said. Okay. The natural theology took different paths in the Catholic world and the Protestant world. You had the success of the new science represented by Newtonian physics that explained planetary motions mathematically in a mechanical model. And English-speaking Protestant natural theologians began focusing on physical contrivances, physical things. While in the Catholic world, you still had the track of kind of the fivefold approach of St. Thomas. And that's what I said. So let's look at an example of how this was done. I am a chemist, and so you got to have a chemist in here somewhere. So the British chemist Robert Boyle, considered one of the founders of modern chemistry, not only gave us the phrase clockwork universe to describe this mechanical model, but he endowed the Boyle lectures. And the Boyle lectures began with his death, and they were to employ natural theology to defend the Christian religion against those he considered notorious infidels, and he lists who those are. But don't descend lower to any controversies that are among the Christians themselves. So take on the infidels, but don't try to defend your particular denomination. You notice that he has redefined natural theology here. It's not to prove that there is a God by reason. It is to defend Christian religion. So he's given it a whole new purpose that didn't come out of the classical thought. So, in those lectures, as you can see, they went into 1965, then lapsed and have been brought back. The early lectures used the classical arguments from design to say in astronomy and Newtonian mechanics, points to God, and in anatomy, blood circulation, this wonderful system points to God. The Boyle lectures did something else. They said that if the new science, which to them explains nature extremely well, could not explain something, then that meant these areas showed the existence and providence of God. Okay? So the great Newton couldn't explain what gravity was. It was, but he couldn't explain it. So that is the providence of God. The providence of God is now a physical phenomenon. And of course, this is very dangerous ground. As you close the gaps in the knowledge, what happens to the providence of God? What happens to God? The Reverend William Paley is the name that most people think of when they think of natural theology, because he wrote Natural Theology in 1802. And he brought up to date the science of the Boyle's lectures. And he began with his story, as everyone knows, by finding a watch, which is really bringing up to date the story that Cicero had. And so he's saying, if this watch is so amazing, think how more amazing is these things that we see in the biological world. And he gave examples of the eye, and he gave examples of the heart. Paley's Natural Theology was the soon a standard text in British higher education. And as many of you know, Charles Darwin studied it at Cambridge, and he states in his autobiography, "I was charmed and convinced of the long line of argumentation." And he writes a lot about Paley throughout his career. But there was problems in the garden of English natural theology. Between the Boyle lectures and Paley, there was David Hume. David Hume, in his Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion, presented a philosophical attack on English natural theology. He stated that nature doesn't need an explanation. Just as God does not need a cause, nature does not need a cause. And he made a statement that sounds so modern to what I've heard. He said that natural theologians are calling design could be nothing more than the properties of nature that results in a life form that sees design. That's just the way we are. We see design, but there is no design. Actually, Hume had very little impact upon natural theology. I think William Paley is still out there coming. But he did have some philosophical impact on fallen philosophers. But between the time of Paley and the time of Charles Darwin, there was John Henry Newman. And Newman was originally an academic and Anglican priest at Oxford. 1845, he converted to Catholicism. And in 1854, he became the founding rector of Catholic University of Ireland. And he began his tenure at Catholic University by giving a series of lectures to the university community, which have been collected into The Idea of the University, etc. Two lectures, which he delivered in 1855, concerned faith and science, and in one of those lectures, he took on English natural theology. He criticized natural theology because it only teaches the power, the wisdom, and goodness of God. And if you think back to even Aristotle, it showed the goodness of God. But he said, what does physical theology, which he called natural theology, tell us of duty and consciousness? What does it teach us of the four last things, death, judgment, heaven, and hell, which are the mere elements of Christianity? He went on to say, I can say physical theology cannot, from the nature of the case, tell us one work about Christianity proper. It cannot be Christian in any of the true sense of the at all. He said it was a pagan thing, going back to the Greeks. And then a different publication, the Tamworth Reading Room Lectures, he said something that I think history has played out. I believe that the study of nature when religious feelings is away leads in mind, rightly or wrongly, to atheism as the simplest and easiest solution. And of course that brings us to Charles Darwin. In 1859, Darwin wrote On the Origin of the Species by Means of Natural Selection. And in that book, he challenged the natural theology of William Paley by giving a natural mechanism for the apparent design in nature. And he challenged the idea that most natural theologians present is that this is perfect design. Nature is perfect, and Darwin challenged that with his many examples. Now let's come to my case study. Charles Darwin and Asa Gray are fascinating. They were contemporaries of each other. They were actually friends of each other. They looked at the same evidence about God and nature and yet reached entirely different conclusions. So the question is why? 5 minutes. Okay, you all know Darwin went on the Beagle. You know that Darwin analyzed his data, and one of the people who did it was Gray. Gray was a doctor who actually was a botanist. And Gray supported evolution, and he promoted Darwin. And Gray said when he looks at nature, he saw a theistic view of nature implied in the book. It was gradual, it was order, it was adapted, and it was led along beneficial lines. And of course, Darwin was repelled by what he saw. Cats playing with mice, wasps laying eggs in the bodies of capillaries. Why so different? Darwin began with Paley, so the god of nature was a god red in tooth and claw, which is Tennyson, and either God's done everything or God's done nothing. Gray did not begin with Paley. He was an evolutionist, but he was also a Christian. Bum, 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 bum. So they reached entirely different conclusions. And so my final thoughts. So as Thomas told us, natural theology is a difficult process requiring time and study in classical philosophy as well as science. Newman said that the use of natural arguments in a mechanical model can lead to deism and atheism. Natural theology must give a true view of nature, the good and the bad. If you want to know the true characteristics of God, then you should look at Scripture. And Scripture and natural theology can see God's involvement. And then finally, natural theology does not appear to be, to me, a silver bullet that always leads to God. Without revealed theology, a distorted view of God's nature can result. Thank you.
We have time for questions. You want to take? Can you repeat the questions?
I will.
I appreciate that. Do you need me to help you or just pick them up?
Oh, yes, sir.
Maybe kind of more a suggestion than a question. But you might also pursue that into the 20th century.
Yes.
Karl Barth, who is kind of saying the same thing more vehemently than Newman in his Nine to Natural Theology. But that leads to the problem that it's hard to see any connection between theology and our understanding of the natural world. And Barth's student, Thomas Torrance, is the one who pointed out you have to start with Revelation. Then you do natural theology in that context of Revelation.
Right. The question was, why didn't I go into the 20th century? And I think 20 minutes per talk is the answer to that. And thank you for that suggestion of Bart and his student, because there are some good examples in the 20th century, but you have to stop somewhere. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Well, Jimmy, I'm going to piggyback right on that, because I would like you to comment. The modern ID movement attempts to qualify as science by suggesting that it says nothing about the nature or the personality of the designer.
Yes, okay.
But, your point here with saying that Asa Gray was led to faith because of he was reaching it up to both revealed theology and natural theology, what would you say to a proponent of ID who tries to say that the evidence of nature points to a designer, but we can't say anything about the designer, the personality of the designer?
Okay. The question was about intelligent design movement, the ID movement, which essentially says that you can look at nature, you can look at the complexity of nature, the irreducible complexity, etc., and say there has to be a designer, but you can't say anything about the nature of that designer. Is that correct? Yes, this is not an attempt, this is not meant to be an anti-ID movement talk. However, from that talk, you do get an impression, maybe, that I question that premise. And I do question that premise because I think it's always possible, it looks like to me, that you can come up with one more physical explanation for complexity. And you get into the you're splitting things tinier and tinier and tinier, and physical answers can do all those tiny little splits, and then you lose the need for a God. And I haven't been convinced that you can escape that box if you're just doing it from the physical, biological world. That's just me. Yes?
Do you consider Genesis chapter 1 material or non-material, and why?
Do I consider Genesis chapter 1 material or non-material, and why? I've never been asked that question. I think that God is telling me that God is a creator. It's telling me that they're, that's as far as I want to go with that. Because I don't look at it as a prescription for how God created the universe, but more importantly, I think to me, in my discussions with students and others, if we get into Genesis chapter 1 by asking questions about this or that, we forget that God was the creator, and to me that's what it's saying. So I don't mean that to be a cop-out, but that's where I'm at. Oh, sorry.
So I agree with you and generally what you're saying, and I quite like Torrance's approach. And I guess, wondering, I often hear from people who disagree, they point to Romans 1 and, and the Psalms and elsewhere, and I guess I always want to say to them, well, okay, if I'm going to say to them, that's not what it's about, it's not, you know, Paul is not arguing in favor of natural theology, well then what is the proper interpretation of Romans 1? And I've read a little bit of Barthes, and it's a little over my head, and so I just wonder if you could recommend, like, what should I say in a nutshell to such a person?
The question is Romans 1, where Paul gives the challenge that you're without excuse because the invisible characteristics of God are seen through the natural. And then how do we respond to that? I don't have an answer for that. It is a challenging verse because of that reason. So this is a very complicated topic. Paul was writing to religious people, maybe not Christians, maybe not Hebrews, but he was writing to religious people. And so you could say in that context, he's saying you should have felt the characteristics of God in these things. But he does say that people are blinded by their sins, if I understand that correctly. And it is a fallen world, and that's some of the problems that Newman had with natural theology, because we are in a fallen world. Yes, if we have time.
Yeah, last question.
Okay, last question. Okay, you, sir, yes.
Since we're talking about 20th century philosophy, how about process thought, particularly Whitehead, who talks about God as having a primordial creative nature that created the universe as we know it, but he also has a consequent nature. He's affected by what happens in the world and what we humans do and what happens to nature. So in a sense, God affected by what happened by the natural world, but God, by poor God, which is also for Hartshorn.
Okay, the question was about, what about process theology, Whitehead's writings? I'll just give you a personal answer there. Whitehead's God is not my God, and I really don't want in my writings to incorporate process theology into that. So that's just me.
Okay. Let's thank Jimmy again.